another episode of Art Class, Lincoln Center's podcast, where we are decolonizing the arts industry and arts education. As always, I am your host, Rocky Jones, and I'm here with my two amazing co-hosts, the lovely, talented Mangrove Forest, we found out earlier. the amazing Paige Reynolds. Hi, Paige. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing well today.
Oh, good. I like your, that is cute, your top.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Yes. It has mushrooms on it.
Oh, okay.
Blue, I feel inspired by nature today. Mm-hmm. Okay. I started my morning with a walk by the river, and now I'm wearing mushrooms and, you know, looking like an ecologist or something. Not a podcaster.
Botanist, mushroom enthusiast, we won't. And of course, the amazing, brilliant Dr. Lee Bynum. Hello, amazing, brilliant Dr. Lee Bynum. How are you today?
Hello, Pacific Rim.
I'm so excited for when we, of course, have like 200 episodes and you're all like, good afternoon, Andorra. What's up, East Swatini? So what is going on in your neck of the woods?
Oh, a little of this, a little of that. I just got back from visiting my family in Virginia.
Oh,
it was my nephew's first birthday.
Oh,
right. Or almost first birthday. It was actually, his birthday is this week, but we celebrated it last week because I'll be traveling this week. And frankly, my nephew's only one, so he can't count to 52. He has no idea what his birthday is. But it was a wonderful time. It was so good to see everybody, to see my nephew kind of walking, and to hear him say almost a dozen different words. It was fantastic.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he's a smart little kid, pointing and screaming and making all kinds of sounds. He wouldn't actually say my name, despite how easy it is to enunciate, but he did point at me and smile a lot. So I'll take it.
Please let's not shade the 51 week year gold.
Still figuring out this language thing. It's going to take a while.
Although I did introduce him to whistling, which he also couldn't do, but he thought it was the most amazing thing he'd ever seen in his life.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, you should see the other tricks I've got up my sleeve. This is nothing, kid. So, yeah.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah, he's a cutie. Happy birthday, Oluwaseyi.
Is that, like, normal to be talking at less than a year old?
I did.
Oh, so, okay.
No. Oh, if I was doing it, I'm completely abnormal. But he also actually it looks exactly like me. My mom had kept saying that. She was like, oh, the baby looks just like you. And I'm like, I really think it looks like my brother. And then she like sent me like side-by-side pictures and was like, I know what my kids look like. And I was like, oh, right. Yes. I yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, Mom.
Well, I just ask because apparently I didn't speak until I was 3. And everyone thought like something was deeply, deeply wrong with me and was very, very concerned. But apparently one day my mom was on the phone and I just like walked up to her and I was like holding a book and I just 3 years of not saying anything. And I just said, Mommy, I'm going to go read this book. So apparently words were in me the whole time. I just didn't have anything to say until that moment. I don't know.
You were literally like, y'all are boring. And I'm going to go over here and read this book.
You're just like, I'm picking it up. I'm picking it up. No, I don't want to be involved in this conversation.
No, thank you.
No.
No, thank you.
And those first words were, you going to read a book? You are going to announce a solo conversation?
Oh, how things change. You can't shut me up. Well, we have an incredible show today. I'm so excited. We have the legend, the legend of legends, Big Frida on the show today.
Woo! You already know.
You already know. And we had such an amazing conversation with them. And it is all in the run-up to me and Paige. We're about to get on a plane. We're about to come to New York. Come see Julie for this incredible, I'm so excited, this hip-hop conference that's happening at Lincoln Center. It's just so exciting and so cool, and I'm so excited to be a little bit of a part of it, I guess. As an attendee, I guess. but I mean, Lee, do you want to talk a little bit more and tell the people?
Oh, I would love to, because I am super, super excited about this. Samuel Phillips, who's our chief of staff, and Robert Torregoy on our team have been working with the brilliant and incredible Martha Diaz, who leads the Hip Hop Education Center. And everybody in New York knows Martha. She's like a literal legend here. So we're so lucky to have her as a collaborator and a thinker around all of these issues that we really wanted to tackle at Fresh, Bold, and So Def Symposium, a tribute to women in hip hop. We'd really been thinking about all of the spaces and places where there was a real substantive, powerful conversation to be had about gender and gender diversity in hip hop and how that's showing up. So we're having this really fantastic conference on April 5th, where the beginning of the day starts with 500 girls and non-binary kids coming to campus from their schools to spend some time with women innovators in hip hop to really think through what it means to mentor the next generation. What are their needs? How are we supporting them? How we show up for them? And really, what does it mean to exist in certain identities vis-a-vis hip hop, right? Like, I don't think it's a real surprise for any of us to have to sort of contend with this idea that what it takes to be successful in hip hop as a woman is fundamentally different from how we position male artists. And then beyond that, how we're thinking about gender expansive folks in the space, right? So I really want to think about that. There is a really brilliant scholar named Dr. Ashley Payne, who teaches at Missouri State University and is an alumna of Howard University. We love Howard University alums here.
H-U. You know.
And she has this really amazing study that came out maybe about 2 years ago around hip hop identity and Black girlhood, and really the ways that hip hop is in conversation with how young Black women see themselves, and also how that then goes back and shapes the music. And first of all, there's not enough research being done really on the experiences that Black women are having in this country in the first place. But this kind of thing that's really thinking about these positions vis-a-vis hip hop are really, really important to me particularly. So yeah, we're going to spend the day talking about everything from how you negotiate as a woman in the space, how you stay grounded and center your self-care, and also the future of hip hop, the past of women in hip hop. We're going to really think through the Me Too moment in hip hop, which is showing up in a really complicated way, but an important way, literally right now, right?
Relevant. So
very relevant, very, very right now. And also we get to have Frida on the show today to actually talk about how they have experienced hip hop and what this has meant from where they sit and what it is to be a non-binary person in the space. So I'm excited about all of the above and, you know, really, really looking forward to this conference.
Yay. I'm looking forward to it too. Like, when I look at the list of speakers and the topics, I'm like, this is literally, as a fan of hip hop, as a listener since I was little, all the things that I sensed were going on, but didn't have a space where it was being made plain, or where women or gender diverse people were really getting into how it affected us specifically. So I'm excited. It's gonna do my current self good, my little self good, who was, you know, listening to Outkast and really liked it, or listening to Missy Elliott and really liked it, but didn't completely understand what was going on and how it was informing my gender. So yay, I look forward to being in the space.
Yay, yeah. We look forward to you being in this space. I will be particularly interested in hearing many of your perspectives about this page.
Absolutely. Me too.
Mm-hmm. Shout out to the team at Lincoln Center. Yay.
Yeah, shout out to everybody at Lincoln Center and everybody who's worked so hard to make this conference happen, and also everybody here and in New Orleans who worked so hard to make this conversation with Frida happen today. It would be an understatement to say how excited I am to have Frida on the show. So,
yeah, I mean, I think I said it was a blessing and an honor, what, like 12 times? But it really was. I mean, it was, as an artist, I've just found her music to be just so incredible and transformative and inclusive and just fun and important. Yes. You know, I know we always joke, it's so important, but important. Absolutely important. So it was super exciting to have this conversation. And of course, stay tuned afterwards, because that's not all we have. We have part one of our conversation with Hannah Mayrie of the Black Banjo Reclamation Project as part of our Kinfolk series with Ella Page. So I don't know if you want to give a little bit of an intro to that.
Oh, you know, I think me and Hannah, it was like talking to someone I already knew. Fabulous, just wonderful, but has a lot of incredible things to say about the banjo, this overall moment of reclamation that we're witnessing, but how it's connected to generations of Black people who have been preserving the history of this instrument, and how the current efforts and what we see in mainstream media and country music and Beyonce and folk music is really the result of many, many years of people either emphasizing that the banjo was always in Black hands or trying to get it into more Black hands present day. So it was really grounding and it was really uplifting. So I'm excited for folks to listen to this interview with Hannah.
Nice. I'm excited too. It was a great one. So if you thought we were done with banjos and Beyonce, but all that plus the morning announcements with Emil and Pure Black Joy. But on the other side of this break, Big Frida, you already know. Welcome back, everybody. I am beside myself with excitement for our next guest. We are so blessed and honored. And of course, this person needs absolutely no introduction, because unless you have been under a rock, you already know. We will give them their accolades. Big Frida is a nationally recognized hip-hop artist, TV personality, cultural influencer, entrepreneur, fierce advocate for racial and gender equity and LGBTQ+ rights, and of course, the ambassador of New Orleans bounce music. I'm sure you know her from her albums, Third Ward Bounce, Louder, Big Diva Energy, in addition to all of the high-profile features that she's been on, like artists like Drake, of course, the Queen Bee, the Grammy-winning Break My Soul, Formation. Last year, Big Frida premiered her new TV show, Big Frida Means Business, chronicling her life and her triumphs in love and relationships, music, like 5011 businesses, girl, cannabis, eyewear, cosmetics, a hotel, which I'm trying to stay at the next time I'm in New Orleans. And we are here to talk about all of it. So excited for you to be here. Thank you so much, Big Frida.
No problem.
Yay. Having me.
So the first thing I wanted to talk to you about is your music. The first time I saw you live, it was, I think it was 2010 or 2011. I was living in Washington, D.C., and I saw you at the Rock and Roll Hotel, which I don't think exists anymore. But, you know, that night it was like all the cool kids were trying to go see Big Frida. It was like, oh, my God, Big Frida's in town. We have to go. We have to go. And I had these two friends of mine, these two white boys, straight white boys. They were like, "Ooh, we want to go see Big Frida with you." And I was like, okay. And so I thought, oh, these are going to be the only two white boys in this room. We walked in there, black, white, Asian, Latinx, queer folks, straight folks, non-binary, men, women. The beat dropped. Everyone had their hands on the knees. Going for it. The room was just sweaty. And like everyone just was having so much fun. And so I was just amazed that, you know, you were able to touch so many people and impact so many people with your music. And so I'm just curious, what do you think it is about New Orleans bounce, about your music specifically, that like is able to create such an impact with so many people? And were you surprised by it, or did you know you had that sauce?
You know, New Orleans bounce is for everybody. It's a up-tempo, heavy bass call and response type music. It is a music that can fill any room up and make people have a great time. It's about, you know, people getting out on the dance floor and being able to express themselves through dance and through music. And I think that bounce music does just that. It just gives the people a chance to allow themselves to get into a space and be free. You know, at one time, I didn't know that, you know, I crossed so many different, you know, so many different areas of different people that love my music. But, you know, starting in 2010, that's when I started to see the music grow even further, and that all different races and different type of, you know, genders of people love my music. I did it for so long in New Orleans that it was just, you know, all it for my black folks here in New Orleans. And then when I started to step outside of New Orleans, I started to see, oh, well, this type of person loves the music. This type of person loves the music. So it started to spread, and I started to see the power that bounce music has.
So powerful. And I mean, I definitely feel it. I had to ask, like, were we at the same show, Rocky? But I think I saw a different show of yours in D.C., and it was the same energy. It was at the Howard Theater near Howard University. So maybe just a little blacker because you had all the students who came to see you.
Yeah, Howard Theater, we had a great time. I remember that show most definitely because we celebrated, like, my mom and, you know, her passing around that time at the Howard Theater. So it was very special, and everybody really came out. I mean, it was standing room only.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was packed. It was, my friend got a lovely pair of Big Frida booty shorts. We had like a wonderful time. And I just want to know, like, there are so many ways in which especially Black LGBTQ music artists are still trying to be heard and acknowledged in a lot of genres and a lot of spaces. But in bounce music, you and others have been visible for a long time, been embedded in the culture. And I wonder, what is it about that space? What is it about New Orleans bounce that has made space for Black, gay, gender expansive, non-binary artists? Like, what is it about bounce music? How do you see it?
I think that, you know, with Katy Rae being the first transsexual to come out with bounce music, it put a stamp on the culture of the music that, you know, identified for all of us to be able to be here. It also allowed us to step into the space and not, you know, worry about what the next person think or what the next person had to say. When she stepped onto the scene, it was big for New Orleans. It was all that was talked about. It was talked about for many, many years. And then when other artists came behind Katy, it also allowed us to, you know, step into that space and really to own that space. I think once I jumped in, I already was in, you know, known for gospel music here in New Orleans. And for when I stepped into the bounce scene, it allowed me to even already have like you know, notability that she's already known in New Orleans for gospel, and now she's stepping into a different type of music, into a different space. And so it allowed me to really just like be known all over the city, and people just started gravitating to the music even more. And, you know, when I stepped in, I said, we're not backing down. We're going full force, and the queens are here to stay, and we got to put our stamp on it. We got to let them know that we can stand our ground just like any, you know, of the heterosexuals that's in the music game.
I'm glad that we were able to talk a little bit about your early years, because we're having a conference and we are welcoming 500 girls and non-binary kids to campus who are interested in hip hop so that they can be mentored by some of rap's women pioneers. If you could go back in time when you were first starting out and give yourself some sage words of advice, what would they be?
What would they be? Save your money, you know.
That's real.
You know, I think that if I can go back and tell myself anything, just to start thinking ahead about things that I can do to help the culture, and meaning that, you know, things that I can think about buying, things that I can think about wanting to put under my belt at an early age, you know, because I thought about some of these things, you know, further down my career. But if I would have thought about these things a little bit sooner, I could have got a little bit more things that I wanted to do here in New Orleans, and meaning like buy property and to, you know, hold down some things that, you know, will be still a staple to New Orleans. Some of the clubs that are no longer here, all of the clubs that I kind of grew up rapping in and hosting and being a part of, none of those clubs are here any longer. So just thinking about some of the those things, that those staples that really made bounce music who they what it is today, you know, thinking back to those times, you know, start to try to be a business owner a little bit sooner, think about buying some property a little bit sooner. But I think that everything else, just the way that I grew up, I think that it was meant to happen that way. And to have that to be my story.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about like your influences growing up, your musical influences. You brought up gospel early on, and New Orleans has just a rich musical legacy that spans so many genres. So yeah, what were you listening to when you were writing?
I mean, I was listening to all of the greats in gospel, you know, like Kirk Franklin, Hezekiah Walker, Shirley Caesar, the Clark Sisters, LaShawn Pace. I was listening to everybody in the gospel world that you could possibly think of. Reverend James Cleveland, Timothy Wright. Growing up, also, I loved the people like Michael Jackson, Patti LaBelle, Dionne Warwick, oh my God, Toni Braxton. You know, all of these people that I grew up listening to were musical influences in my life. Little Richard, you know, Stevie Wonder, Kelly Price. There were so many greats that I listened to growing up. And I think that they all played a big part in my life. Michael Jackson, especially, being with all of the great songs, Man in the Mirror, and all of the songs that really were impactful and powerful in my life. Those are the type of songs, when you put those songs on, I was at tears as a teenager growing up, trying to figure out who I was and where I fit it at in society.
Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Go ahead.
When I was listening to your list, and it basically was the same as my list, I would imagine that for many of the young hip-hop and pop artists, whether they're queer or not right now, list you as an inspiration, right? So what are your hopes for this up-and-coming generation of artists who are entering the music industry now? What kinds of things do you want to hear and see from them?
I mean, I want them first and foremost to be themselves and to go out there and show the world who they are. You know, my mom used to always say, go out there and show them who you are. Stand up and be a man and go out there and be you. And the most important thing is for them, for a person to be themselves and to be comfortable with themselves. Because if you're comfortable with yourselves, then you can go out there and share with the world. you have to be comfortable in your own space and in your own, you know, music or whatever you're doing in life. And for people that's just, you know, stepping into the music business, you know, be confident, be strong, be bold, you know, take chances, take risks on some things. A lot of times I tell people, if I'm happy with the music that I'm putting out, I think my fans will be happy with it. And that's usually where I land at with it.
Well, I'm super curious because, you know, as somebody who in my teens and early 20s tried for a little bit to, you know, have a career in music, I'm sure you know well, especially at the beginning of your career, that you do face a lot of adversity. You do face, you know, rejection at times, and, you know, that can be really hurtful. And so, you know, to those same kids, what would you say to them, you know, when they're feeling those, when they're facing that kind of adversity and you're thinking, oh, is this right for me? How do you, what gives you strength to keep going in those moments?
Well, my 2P formula is to pray and to push. I pray about the situation. I keep on pushing. I push forward. A lot of times I don't have time to beat myself up about a situation that's at hand. I pray about it and I keep on pushing forward. You know, the most important thing that I can say is if you believe in it and if you believe in yourself, keep on moving forward. Because a lot of times things may not seem the way they are or feel the way that they should be. But in the long run, you will see, you know, the end result of that situation. And if you just stick in there and you hold tight and you keep on pushing forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ashe. And I'm so glad to see you pushing forward in the way that you have. It's beautiful to hear about all the different bags that you're in with business right now. And I especially want to talk about the new hotel and restaurant. So I've lived in New Orleans for about 6 months now, and I've definitely seen something that people have warned me about and that I'm familiar with is somebody from Detroit. People who are not from here love the culture, move here, take up a lot of space and displace people who are from here, who have been the cultural keepers, the stewards of the culture that they love so much. So in this moment where New Orleans and a lot of places are dealing with gentrification, what does it mean to you to be opening up this hotel and restaurant at this moment? Like, what does it mean to your personal legacy and New Orleans overall?
It's exactly that. It is to, you know, put my staple here in New Orleans and to leave my legacy, you know, whenever that time may come. But it is also to represent for the city of New Orleans and to have a place where people could come and they could get a moment of the culture. They can get a moment of freedom. They can get a moment of what I like, the type of food that I like, the type of music that I like, you know, and to party like I party. So this hotel and restaurant will give them a chance to step into freedom world and, you know, get that exact moment that I want everybody to have when they come to New Orleans and to represent for my city, most importantly, to have that place where they can say, oh, I went to Frida Hotel and oh my God, I had the time of my life. I had, the food was, you know, amazing. It felt like New Orleans. It tasted like New Orleans. It was New Orleans. And that's the staple that I want to leave here when Hotel Frida comes. Mm-hmm.
So we talk a lot on this show about the contributions and the experiences of Black artists. And unfortunately, a lot of those instances, we're talking about how the music industry in particular can be really exploitive and really extractive. And I have really loved seeing your ventures because I feel like, you know, in addition to your like really being able to define your legacy and your whole contribution to the culture on your own terms, I feel like it's also a way that sort of addresses how the industry can take from people in these kinds of ways and the need maybe just to establish something independent of that for yourself. Was there any of that when you were thinking about some of the ventures that you were embarking on in the last couple of years?
I mean, for me, not really. I just go with the flow, you know, with a lot of happens in my life. But I also, you know, I know that I'm on the radar and being watched and representing for the culture and for the people of New Orleans. So when I started to, you know, expand and to go outside of New Orleans and to, you know, become more international with the bounce music and all of the things that I'm doing, I just also made sure that I also watch the way that I do things and the way that I present, you know, my music and the way that I present, you know, for the culture and for the people of New Orleans. Because a lot of times they will take the simplest little thing and try to flip it. And so, you know, most importantly, I continue to be myself, but also make sure that I'm not doing anything to make sure that the culture is represented wrong, or I'm representing myself wrong, or my family, or my friends, or the people that have helped me push me to get where I'm at thus far. So, you know, most importantly, just do me and just keep on pushing and praying, like I said, throughout all of it. You know, a lot of times you can look at a lot of these, the people in the music industry, and they are being exploited and they are doing things that, you know, we may feel like, oh, they're letting, you know, this certain type of label make them do this, or they're letting their managers make them do this or that. But for me, I'm the captain of my ship, and I always want to lead my ship in the right direction and make sure that we're staying afloat and that we're not sinking underwater.
So I'm just curious, in your wildest dreams, what do you think these organizations, these institutions, these labels could do to better support artists of color, mm-hmm. young queer artists, to, you know, hopefully have, you know, the kind of careers that you have?
Give them a chance, first and foremost. You know, take a chance on some of these new artists out here and give them a chance and invest in them and you know, support their career and their dreams. And that's the biggest thing that they can do. You know, getting behind them and putting some money behind them and really helping them to develop themselves and to develop their career and to really push them to be big stars.
Mm-hmm. That's brought up something similar for me of like artists from New Orleans specifically. Like, what can people do to make sure that they are supporting artists in an authentic way, in a way that preserves the culture and doesn't just take it and try to make money off it? What does that look like for you? And even if you have advice for people on the other side who are from New Orleans and are trying to make it in this wild world that is the entertainment industry, that is the arts industry.
So I think, like, going to the shows, buying the music, you know, that is two of the biggest things that they can do. They can go to the shows and to support the artists. They also can buy their music to help the artists to support themselves and their families. And for artists as well, continue to push the music. Don't give up. Because a lot of times you get discouraged, and when you don't have that support, a lot of artists don't have the resources or the money to push themselves to get even further. Here in New Orleans especially, we have so many great bounce artists that are, you know, trying to get to the next level or whatever. And it took me 10 years just alone to get heard outside of New Orleans, I think, to become international. But I never gave up. I was at my point where I felt like I was going to give up. And then just right when I felt like I was going to give up, then something turned around for me and things started to push forward. So not giving up, you know, steady pushing forward and you know, hard work pays off. Like they say, you have to put the work in order to get the fruits of your labor. And for people, for supporting artists, buy the music, go to the shows, support in any kind of way that you can, support their merchandise, support what they have going on. And that will help those artists to push forward even further.
Mm-hmm. Make me want to go buy some concert tickets right now.
I have some shows coming up. You're here in New Orleans too.
Oh, I'll be there.
I might have to fly down.
Oh, come visit. We'll make a whole outing of it. Yeah, let's do it.
Don't tempt me, because I'll be there tomorrow ringing the doorbell. But speaking of buying the music and new music, I want to hear about your new project. Is what's coming up for 2024?
So for 2024, I am working on my new Christmas project. Ooh. Which, I mean, yeah.
Okay.
It's a Christmas. I had a Christmas tour last year, and it was phenomenal. And it was my first time actually going out and doing my Christmas music live. I had been making these Christmas albums for a while now, and so 2023 was the first time that I was able to go out and actually perform my Christmas music live, which was phenomenal. I mean, they were trying to book it before I even left for 2024. So we are working on the new Christmas project and the new Christmas tour. But as recording new music right now, I am working on my gospel album that is coming out in 2022. And taking it back from, you know, just taking it back from where I started, and to also remind people that we're here only because of the grace of God, and that we are nothing without God, and I'm nothing without God. And so I want to take it back to where I started at, and to give God the glory for just all allowing me to be here and through my music, and, you know, want to speak to the people.
Amen. That's beautiful.
I want to come see your Christmas show so bad.
You got to come. We had such a great time. We was like starting to try to plan Christmas as soon as we got off the Christmas tour.
All signs are pointing to a field trip to Hotel Frida Christmas 2024. I think we just solved what we're doing.
Yes, yes, absolutely, yes. Absolutely. Well, Big Frida, I'm looking at the time, and I just want to thank you so, so much for joining us. This was such a blessing. And where can the people find you? Where's the tour going? Where can people buy tickets? All that good stuff.
So BigFrida.com, you can check out all your tour dates. You can check out all things related Frida. I'm on Instagram at BigFrida.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Snapchat. I'm on anything that you think of. And you shall find me. The Christmas tour will be announced probably no later than the late summer. And I hope to see you guys at the Christmas tour. And Hotel Frida will be coming soon. We're working really hard to have it open by 2025 before the Super Bowl. And so hopefully we will be able to sit at Hotel Frida and have some great dinner and, you know, have a great stay there and some great music and lots and lots of fun.
Well, you've had me a great dinner, so. So I'll be there. I will be there. Well, everybody go check out BigFrida.com. And Big Frida, thank you so, so much for being here.
Appreciate it.
This was amazing. And we'll be right back, everybody.
Hello, classmates. It's Emile here again to bring you the morning announcements. I am your resident violinist with a passion for arts collaboration, and I'm here to encourage you to go experience live art. The following is a short list of events and experiences that we here at Art Class think are cool and you might want to check out. First, if you just heard the conversation with Big Frida, maybe you're already looking for tickets to a show. If not, let me be the nudge you need to go see Big Frida live. Fans are raving, saying it's a hell of a show and that Big Frida always delivers. A quick check of the interwebs and you will find the new album was released 9 months ago, and Big Frida tickets are now on sale for shows in New Orleans, Austin, Texas, Nashville, Tennessee, North Carolina, and California throughout the spring and summer. Don't be the one to miss out on all the fun. Next, I would like to mention our own Lincoln Center Education Department as they bring us the inaugural Fresh, Bold, and So Deaf Symposium, a tribute to women in hip-hop. Taking place Friday, April 5th, this all-day event spotlights the often unsung heroines who have played a pivotal role in shaping the landscape of hip-hop culture. Held at Lincoln Center's Alice Tully Hall, this all-day symposium showcases the rich tapestry of talent and innovation brought forth by women trailblazers in a male-dominated industry. Events run throughout the day and range from performances and panels to lectures and roundtable discussions. The day culminates in a performance by the Ladies of Hip Hop Dance Collective and a roundtable discussion with courageous women who will share how they were able to speak out to hold society accountable and raise the bar for the culture. Lincoln Center encourages those interested to stay for the duration of the symposium or come for their favorite part, stressing all are welcome and feel free to stop by throughout the day. Finally, in a nod to our kinfolk guest for this episode, I would like to highlight another Black banjo performer who is currently on tour and worth checking out live. Trajan, or Trey Wellington, grew up in North Carolina's Ash Country, and after hearing banjo for the first time, he was immediately hooked. He earned early acclaim as the banjo player for Cane Mill Road and then branched out on his own with his self-titled Trey Wellington Band. His full-length debut album, Black Banjo, was introduced to the world in 2020. He has been interviewed by Rhiannon Giddens for her BBC documentary series Black Roots and by W. Kamau Bell for his CNN series United Shades of America. The Trey Wellington Band has shows throughout the spring and summer, and the tour touches both coasts of the United States. In case you need a preview, his website has music and videos that showcase both his band and his own expertise. If you'd like more information on any of the events I've highlighted, check out the links in the show notes, and I'll be back next time with more cool live art for you to experience. Bye, friends.
Welcome back to another segment of Kinfolk. This is a segment of Art Class where we explore the artistic and cultural traditions of the Black diaspora everywhere, from people here on Turtle Island to folks in the Caribbean to our common roots in the African continent. And so I'm so excited to present part one of this conversation with the Black Banjo Reclamation Project. And we're covering this because the banjo is one of those instruments, those crafts that has a direct connection to our African roots, to our traditions of playing gourd stringed instruments, and has not only been just a part of music and entertainment, but actually part of ritual, a part of ceremony for Black folks. And there's a long line of people who have preserve this tradition, and we're kind of in a moment of creation, that kind of cultural preservation just being at the forefront again and being reassociated with Black people as it should have always been. So I'm so excited to present part one of Kinfolk with the Black Banjo Reclamation Project. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome back, everybody. Class is back in session. And we have an amazing guest with us here today. I am so, so excited to welcome our guest, Hannah Marie, from the Black Banjo Reclamation Project. Hannah is a creative facilitator and musician whose work and art lends itself as a tool for redesigning and reconnecting to our roots as humans on this planet. A banjoist, multi-instrumentalist, and vocalist, Hannah shares original and traditional banjo compositions, harmonies through acoustic live vocal looping, and reminds us of the power found in our relationship to the earth, music, and community. They founded the Black Banjo Reclamation Project, reclaiming banjo and Black earth-based cultural practices through self-determination and reparations. Powerful stuff. Welcome, Hannah. So excited to have you.
Thank you so much. So good to see you and hear you.
Yes. So tell us all about Black Banjo Reclamation Project. Where did this idea come from? What does it look like? Introduce us.
For sure. Yeah. And like so much of the work that I do is personal to me. And then a lot of it is sort of how I've taken the personal experience as an artist and kind of transmuted that as being a radical arts administrator, basically. I feel very much that my work as an artist is connected and supported by Black Banjo Reclamation Project. And I feel like I identify what it's like to be a Black folk musician in the world today, whether that's like just wanting to learn music, wanting to put out music, wanting to record, wanting to perform, wanting to collaborate. All of that is kind of, you know, things that I have experienced as an artist, which has been a huge journey in and of itself that like precedes the Black Banjo Reclamation Project. That's kind of like the foundation that I'm sitting on, is just being a musician and growing from that. And with Black Banjo Reclamation Project, I definitely see it as like a folk music and land-based institution that is the opportunity to engage with the banjo through many different pathways. And the main ones that we have focused on for it to be this holistic experience is, you know, music and cultural education and history. It has been music education specifically. It has been spirituality. It has been community. And it has also been the connection with the earth that has really been the foundation for everything that we're doing. And of course, just with this being a practice of Black liberation, it's really important to acknowledge the role that working with land has, as far as like when we talk about getting free, you know, music is something that can do that for us on a personal level, even in like literally the shackles of society. And that's something that I think the banjo has been used for a very long time. Whereas I think it's important just acknowledging that the land is what it makes it possible, not only for us to have the banjo as it is made from plants, but it's what connects us back to the continent and the practices and the traditions that actually birth this instrument. And so, yeah, it's really, it's been a super expansive thing. It's something that I know we're going to be growing into for a very long time. And I definitely call it and consider it an ecosystem and an institution. So I'm so glad that we're 5 years in to this project and to this organizing. And we're, you know, we're now in our sixth year and we're just watching it change and grow.
It's so beautiful to hear you talk about it being not just about the instrument, the banjo itself, but our whole connection to the earth, to each other, to our roots. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about like why, or at least from your perspective, how we even became disconnected from the banjo in the first place.
Sure. I mean, I think just to start off, I think that there's a lot of Black people who have the experience of culturally coming up with this. And so there was never a separation. I think it's important to acknowledge that the culture that we have as Black people, which is, as you all know, like sometimes very much discounted as being a culture. It's kind of like, oh, that's Black. It's sort of like, it's not African, it's not this, it's not that. It's like that there is culture that has traveled with people that is still in play today, that even through the interruptions of colonization, people have maintained that. So I think that's like, there are people who have been stewards of the banjo this whole time. And I appreciate that, because that's where, you know, we can acknowledge that connection as Indigenous. We can acknowledge it as coming from the continent and also being part of the diaspora. So there's that. There are people who are not disconnected from the banjo, and because it has always been with Black people. On the other side of that, I think it's fair to say that like racism has been an interruption of the banjo, and colonization has been an interruption of this, because even before, you know, white people knew what banjos were, they existed on this continent. And, you know, as they say, people had not only like brought the materials and the seeds so that they were able to continue those practices, but they had the knowledge. People had brought the knowledge with them of how to do that. And so it was always originally that it was always something that was for and by Black people, African people. And I think that white people essentially just in this last like couple of hundred years have managed to really like just take up a ton of space in the banjo, in the world of the banjo, in the instrument, as far as like taking these instruments, holding the instruments captive. I mean, you are holding people. There was people that were held hostage. It was land that was, you know, people were displaced from. And, you know, adding this instrument into the mix is a real thing that has not necessarily taken it away from Black people, some would argue, but it had rebranded it for sure and made it into something that was used for minstrelsy, you know, which is adding insult to the injury that was slavery. So it's like you had to actually take it so many levels. Like, white people have a lot of deconstructing. If you ask me about this, like, this is actually like the part of the conversation where it's like, and this is where white people get to step into this space of not just enjoying the fruits of Black people's labor that they have like not only literally slaved away on this land to preserve our survival, but like this rebranding, this way of co-opting, you know, as far as bluegrass music, as far as like country music, putting a white face onto something that was always traditionally Black, there is work to be done by our European counterparts. And I'll just say that. And, you know, I spend a small amount of my energy focusing on that because I think it's important. And I think that's important for the reparations piece. But I think it's really important that, like, specifically with this project, it's really focused on the self-determination piece of now that we live in this world, now that we have grown up in this world, how are we transforming the conditions that we're in so that we're accessing the things and the tools and the resources that are actually our birthright, that are actually our cultural right to be in connection with the land, to be in connection with something that is actually outside of this world that grounds us in this world and allows us to go through on the daily basis. Because yes, even though slavery is abolished, there are still many, many ways that people are being forced to do things, you know. We're not just granted, oh, that you can just exist in this world. And so the interesting thing about as this develops is, you know, when we're looking at liberation, when we're looking at reclamation, we're not just looking at it in terms of like the programming that we offer. It's also around like the economic consequences of this. For me, I'm really interested in like, I would really like to know, and I would love to find, if you are somebody who like works in history and statistics and stuff like that, literally call me, literally hit me up, because I am really curious, like, to find out how much reparations is actually due to Black people through the banjo. Mm. Like, when you're talking about creating companies, wow, when you're talking about putting patents on banjos, when you're talking about like selling, yep, records, when you're talking about even just health, I want to know a dollar amount, because all of that has a dollar amount. And that's been part of the process. Is actually, it's been really interesting. I said, we do work with white people. We do collaborate with people. And part of that is to say, we're open to receiving the support of banjos and monetary reparations from people who are actually, like, for example, literally making their entire living off of banjos. That is a real economic consequence that, like, Black people should be benefiting from, if you ask me. I think a lot of us agree with that. And so I think one of the things that I'm most proud of is, like, some of the work that we're doing here at BBRP involves creating opportunities for craftsmanship and for luthiership, because there aren't a lot of Black people who have had the opportunity to build a banjo, let alone make an entire career out of it. And so, like, that's something that we're supporting by doing these banjo building workshops. You know, there's the economic side of it, which is like, these are transferable skills, you know, not only for construction or for woodworking, but also for banjo repair. You know, like, these are jobs that do get paid more than minimum wage. And so it's like, can we support people in getting into those fields, not just in sort of like performance representation? Like, that's super important too. And right now we're transitioning, like, some of the work I'm doing is supporting artists and being sort of like a radical advocate for people who are maybe like on tour as like a Black country or folk music. Like, we want to take up all the space that we can in these different fields, whether that's academia, whether that's performance, whether that's, you know, music industry stuff, but also just on the land, just being people, where it's like, I don't want to be out here fighting for anything. Like, I just want to exist. People need to do that. And so we're also just focusing on the creation of like those opportunities that allow people to say, I am in nature. Maybe I'm going to write a song. Maybe I'm going to do something for me. Maybe I want to do something for my own lineage, you know, to honor that. So there's like so many spiritual implications of working with the land and working with animals. There's economic, you know, implications. There's so many different ways that the banjo, through my own philosophy that I've, you know, as far as working with this instrument and working with people, it just keeps growing, you know, and we keep getting deeper into like making relationships with organizations and people and researchers and literally just indigenous people of Africa and people who hold all of these different parts, because it feels like it's a collective story to tell. It doesn't feel like it's my story. It feels like it's something that belongs to a vast amount of people who are like embarking on this journey and using it as a way to heal themselves and to learn more and to connect more with community.
So I hear you saying we have kept the connection to the banjo because it's part of our connection to the land, to our connection to spirit. That's just like inherent things that can't be taken away. There are people who have stewarded this knowledge, who have stayed connected with it directly. It's more that the connection was mocked, exploited, and co-opted, as so many parts of our cultural production is. So, you know, a story we're familiar with. And it sounds like it's so interconnected to just healing our relationship with our autonomy in general. As I was hearing you talk, I was reminded of like how I was raised as kind of an outdoorsy kid. And, you know, I had like father, grandfathers and stuff who still went fishing and hunting and were out on the lakes. And, you know, I was playing in the woods, and then they very much raised me with like, no, this is your birthright. Like, no, we're not afraid to go to the national parks. No, we're not afraid to do that. Like, you belong here like anybody else. Like, or rather, you belong to the earth, you know?
And we are back. And as I said at the beginning, that was part one of our conversation with Hannah Marie. So stay tuned for part two next time around. And right now, oh, and thank you, Paige. That was fabulous.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Oh, good. Okay, no, we have to stop laughing. My mom is going to get mad.
My bad. Sipping it.
Sorry. Inside joke for the scorekeepers. But it is time for our very favorite part of the show. It is time for Pure Black Joy, where we talk about the Black people, places, things, ideas, culture, food, music, art that's making us happy this week. And this week's Pure Black Joy goes out to all the kids that were raised by Victor Newman. Erica Kane, Dr. Marlena Evans, Sunny Corinthos, because we just got word last week that CBS is developing the first Black daytime soap opera in 35 years. It's called The Gates, which is going to be the first daytime show with a predominantly Black cast since 1989's Generations. And y'all, we just watched a clip from Generations. Vivica Fox.
Come on, Vivica.
And this lady, they're kicking off the shoes and their earrings and tussling around this apartment. It, oh my God, it was everything.
Drama.
So good.
So good. So good.
And I don't know about y'all, but I love daytime soaps. I have loved them for such a long time. My mom was a Young and the Restless girlie, and she would come home, she would tape it, and then we would have dinner, and then she would watch her story while we had dessert. And it was so much fun. It was so incredible. I probably didn't understand half the things that were happening until I was older, but all I just knew that it was juicy. That's all I knew.
Catherine Chancellor was not playing with them kids.
She'd
be like 80 years old, and she and Jill were still fighting.
Still fighting over that man who's been dead for 30 years.
That's what intrigued me. That's about beef. The stories my grandma watched. The beef is long. The beef is long.
Long. Long. And so it's so exciting, especially at a time when it seems like daytime dramas are, you know, falling off the cliff. That, you know, that CBS is investing in a predominantly Black show it's amazing. And I feel like we have, like, you know, our nighttime soaps, Power, Empire, what have you, but like a daily predominantly Black soap opera on network TV, like that is awesome. That's the stuff of dreams. That's what I wanted to, that's when I moved to New York. That's what I wanted to do. At the Sphinx conference last year, Paige and I met Michael R. Jackson, and he was talking in his keynote about how when he moved to New York, he wanted to write a daytime soap. So I don't know. Yep. It's just,
hey, it's never too late.
It's never too late.
Right.
It's never too late. It really is it. So kudos to CBS. I can't wait to watch The Gates. It's gonna be dope.
Yeah. Me too.
I'm excited.
But I think that's going to do it for us today. Oh, and we should probably also mention that we have a live show coming up.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
We do.
Right. We want everybody, literally everybody, to come to it. It's going to be amazing.
It's going to be fantastic. It's going to be April 10th at 7:30 p.m. at the David Rubenstein Auditorium at Lincoln Center. And I heard a rumor that there might be a very special guest.
Yeah, this may be a Black queer icon of, you know, that's what I heard.
I mean, do we want to say who, or do we want to make it a surprise? Well, I guess it's on the website.
This isn't the kind of thing that we want to hide from people. We want everybody to know that we get to talk to the great Afrofuturist musical legend, Nona Hendrix, one, the only.
Can you believe it?
I kind of can't believe it. And I think it's also worth noting that it's part of a in-person podcast festival called Hear It Here. And we'll also be hearing from some other really amazing shows, Moving Moments with Alicia Graf Mack and Damian Wetzel, Speaking Soundly with David Krause and the great Joyce DiDonato, and She Pivots with Emily Tish Sussman are the other parts of the festival playing throughout April and beginning of May here at Lincoln Center. Super excited to be a part of it. Right? Wow. Right?
We're part of a whole lineup.
Okay. We're at a festival, honey. You know, I read something the other day that a group of Sagittariuses, or it's called a festival.
Like a murder of crows, like
yes, this right? kind yes. of a festival oh, okay. of Sagittarians. Yes.
A festival of Sagittarians. Oh, I like mm-hmm. it. I like mm-hmm. it. I think ours is probably a disaster of Aquarians. That sounds about right.
Or like a mothership.
Yeah. Or a conspiracy.
Ooh, that's a good one. That's good.
Let's go with that.
Anyway, if you, no matter what your star sign is, if you are in New York on April 10th, we hope that you will come and see us and Nona, and it's going to be dope. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
I can't believe we got past our Secret Service somehow.
You let us through.
Ooh, what am I going to wear? Oh, Jesus. All right. Anyway. But I think that's going to do it for us. Any words of wisdom before we go?
You know, it's not a word of wisdom. It's actually like a strange regret. Oh. While we had Frida here,
yeah,
for our PB&J segment, we should have asked if we could have the rights to peanut butter.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Next time.
That's going to make our theme song. Season two. I mean, season two.
Well, I guess the word of wisdom then in that case is ask for what you want.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
there you go.
You won't ask, you won't receive.
Close mouth, don't get fed. Close mouths, don't get the PBJ. All right, everybody, we will see you in 2 weeks, where we will have the great Hilton Alls and Woo! Part two of our conversation with Anna Mary. And until then, be easy, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye, Aunt Dora.
Class dismissed.
Class dismissed.